All right, good evening, everyone. My name is Todd. I'm an alcoholic. First, I'd like to thank Billy for asking me to come out here and speak. I feel very honored to be able to come up here and talk about my recovery from alcoholism. And even though I'm a little nervous, I'm very comfortable in a room with alcoholics like you guys. It's just a good place for me to be. And I'm very grateful to be standing here today because I am not the same person today that I was before I found Alcoholics Anonymous by far. A couple things I'll just get out the way. My sobriety date is April 13th, 1999. My home group is Into Action of Richmond, Virginia. We meet Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 o'clock. Tuesdays is a closed meeting, so it's just for alcoholics or people who think they might have a problem with alcohol. We do a prepared topic and a big book study and a newcomers meeting. Three different groups to choose from Tuesday nights. And there's an Al-Anon meeting that meets Tuesday. And we have babysitting. So if you have kids, you don't have any excuses, you can bring them too. It's free babysitting. Thursdays we have babysitting too, and it's an open meeting for everyone, and we have speakers on Thursday nights. So that's just a little bit of information about where I come from and where what I do. Like I said, I am definitely just very grateful to have found Alcoholics Anonymous, and the way it's changed my life has been it's been unreal, man. I didn't drink for a long time. I actually I only drank for 4 years. I got sober very young, so I don't know how much I'm going to talk about my drinking. We'll see what comes out. Sometimes, I want to focus. I'd like tonight to try to focus on. I'm going to qualify myself and talk a little bit about my drinking. But I've been sober now for longer than I've drank. So for a long time, when I shared, I wasn't able to share a whole lot about my sobriety because I didn't grow much at the beginning. You know, I didn't do what I was suggested to do. And when someone asked me to speak, I'd talk, 55 minutes about my drinking because that's all I could really relate to. I was just glad I found other people. But hopefully tonight we'll get into a lot more of the kind of what has happened to me since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I grew up in this fellowship. You know, I mean, I got sober when I was 18 years old, and I only picked up one white chip. I only had to pick up one white chip. But I have not... I spent a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous not doing the entire program. But for some reason, by the grace of God, I don't know why, but it never got... It did get to the point where I wanted to pick up a drink, and I'll get into that a little bit later. But for some reason, I haven't picked up a drink. I guess my higher power has got some better use for me, because there were times in AA where I sought out to drink, and I'll get into one of those. But anyways... So, I come from a long line of alcoholics. You know, we were talking before the meeting about I come from a family where I was born in a very Christian home, and we didn't talk about it. In my family, we just kind of talk about just the surface stuff. You know, like I just found out about 6 months ago, you know, I had a great aunt who committed suicide. I just found out that my grandparents' brother, my grandmother's brother, killed himself and killed his wife. You know, I mean, it was basically alcoholism that did it. And this stuff isn't talked about in my family, but it's rampant. You know, I mean, like, everybody in my family is either bad drunk or does not drink at all because of the alcoholism in my family. And I didn't find out that, I mean, thank God a lot of people in my family have found Alcoholics Anonymous and gotten sober. My dad's been sober for over 30 years. You know, he doesn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it definitely shows. He went to AA for a long time, was involved for about 5 years. I've never seen him drink, but I guess it's better than drinking, but he's an alcoholic. My sister's been sober for 10 years. And even my grandmother at 81 years old came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wasn't an alcoholic, but it was just kind of the popular thing to do in my family at the time was to come into AA. So it's kind of weird family, you know. It's like, we're going to AA meeting. Grandma, come on, you know, it's good. So when my grandfather died, I guess this was about 6-7 years ago, my grandfather died of alcoholism. And my grandmother started drinking heavily after his death. And she was just a hard drinker. She, like, drank one time, slipped and fell, said she had a problem, she needed to go to AA, just because everybody else was doing it, like I said. And she found that after a couple of weeks that her bridge club was keeping her as sober just as well as AA was. So she probably wasn't an alcoholic, you know. But anyway, so come from a long line of drunks. My father, I really was born. I was the only reason I'm here today. I was even born was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. My father was a really bad drunk. Couldn't hold a job. My sister was born, and he had to stay home while my mom. I come from a long line where, like, most of the alcoholics in my family were the males, and the men, the disease just hit him so bad that they had to go on disability or they died, and the women really had to. I mean, great Al-Anons, really. They had to come in and really just take over everything. And my mom was that force in my childhood. She was the breadwinner. She did everything, you know. Even when my dad, I never saw my dad drink, but, you know, even when he was sober, my mom did everything. You know, my dad just kind of, he worked and he just had to deal with his own thing. But, so my mom, and I didn't find out about any of this stuff until after I got sober, because, again, we just don't talk about this stuff in my family. And my dad, he was really bad off drinking, and he was unemployable, and my parents were about to get a divorce. And my father, my mom would check he'd have to stay home and watch the kid, my sister, who was, you know, 6 months old, and my mom would say, you need to stay home with this baby. At the time, she wasn't, couldn't travel for some reason or something. And she would check the odometer on the car, and when she got back from work every day, there was more miles on the car because he would go out and buy liquor and just leave the kid, this little baby, at home while he went to the ABC store and got liquor, you know, and just drank all day. He ended up getting a horrible accident and was in a coma for a couple weeks, to the point where he couldn't use his hands, and he'd drink liquor through a straw. They'd just feed him liquor through a straw just to get him through. But he found Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober, and I guess my parents celebrated and had another kid, which was me, you know, so got rid of the alcoholism and put it in me. But so anyways, that's a little bit about the history of my family. Growing up, like I said, I look at my life, my childhood, and I cannot tell you there was something that happened in my life that made me an alcoholic. I think I was just, I have alcoholism. I didn't get alcoholism. I don't know. Maybe people can. I'm not saying that's like a statement of fact. I'm just saying I know. You know, like, I had it. I've always had it. Even as a little kid, I can just see the characteristics of alcoholism that I always had. I needed a lot of attention growing up. And like I said, I grew up in a family where, you know, we don't show affection in my family. My father to this day still has a hard time giving me a hug. You know, if I want love from my parents, I have to seek it out. You know, I mean, nowadays I've learned how to tell my parents I love them, and I'll seek it out. And you know, sometimes they're responsive to it, and sometimes it's just they're not, you know. But so I never got that. I think it was kind of understood, but I didn't. It was kind of an independent living for me. They did the best they could with what they had, but. I remember at a very early age, like I said, we grew up in a Christian family, but when we went to church, I'll never forget, my mom said, you know, I told her I don't want to go to church. And she said, you need to go to church just to make me happy. You know, you need to make your mom happy. So that's why I went to church. I never once sat in church as a kid and thought, I need to listen for individual growth, for any individual reason. The only reason I thought I had to go was to make mom happy. That was it. You know, I never listened. I just sat there quietly. Even when I got older, I just did this to satisfy mom. You know, it wasn't nothing that applied to me. You know, so I never, like, I thought other people were doing that too. These are thoughts. Is that no one's here literally listening to this priest talk about, how to get in touch with Jesus. I mean, he's just saying that because that's what he's got to do. You know, that's his job. I had no idea that maybe this would apply. And I had a good childhood. I mean, I was given everything I needed. You know, I grew up in a good home. But I remember at a very early age, I went to Christian school. I mean, and I could spout out the Beatitudes, all that stuff. I mean, I was, you know, I knew all about religion, but I just, and like a some kind of higher power that I have a relationship with, it just never, not once, every single Sunday of sitting in that church did I ever think about that. It's just so weird that it just never crossed my mind, you know? But I remember at a very early age, I remember sitting in my room and thinking about this God thing. Like, is there really a God? And I thought, there probably is. There probably is a God. But I heard about, you know, praying, you need to pray and stuff and all this. But, I mean, I was, I don't know, 11, 12 years old, and I thought, I don't know, my life's going pretty well. Why do I need to anything else other than my own self-will to run it? You know, I think from that point on, I kind of abandoned the thought of prayer or any kind of, I don't know, dependence on anything other than myself. So from that point on, really, it was self-will, man. That's all I ever ran on was my own instinct and my own character, my own ideals or thoughts that came into my head. I ever used as counsel, you know. And it worked for a while, you know. I became, like I said, I was kind of the class clown. I knew how to work the crowd. I was kind of I was pretty popular in middle school and high school, and I always needed so much attention, man. I mean, I needed a whole lot of attention, and I got that from being funny and for a long time getting good grades. My parents, you know, would praise me for that. But at a point, it got kind of boring doing that same old thing, and I needed more. I needed more to feel fulfilled. And growing up, I was athletic, but I had this drive which went away. I know why it went away, because I could not be the best at everything. I wanted to be the best at everything. I wanted to be the best baseball hitter, pitcher, catcher, second baseman, every position. You know, if I wanted to be the best center field, I mean, if I could play and be on a baseball team all by myself when I was in Little League, I would have. Because there was always some kid that would miss a fly ball. Man, I could play left field better than him. I felt like I could take on an entire baseball team. I had that much ego already. Like, I wanted to be the best student, the best speller, the best math person, the best English. I mean, everything. I wanted to be the most popular. And it was being revealed that I there was always someone better in some category of life, you know. And it just ate at me so bad. I didn't know how to deal with that. My parents didn't really teach me any kind of social skills. You know, I just kind of learned on the fly. Or maybe they did, and I just didn't listen. But I just remember just developing resentment against anybody that was better than me. Just at a very early age. Just if they beat me in a spelling contest, I just had to find something that was at fault with them. I'm better at math, you know, and that's more important. You know, or they're not athletic, you know, or they're not whatever. You know, I can run faster than them or something. If you were better at me than anything, then I didn't like you. So that rules out, basically, I've developed resentments against everybody. I mean, pretty much, you know, because usually someone was better at something, you know. And so I was going into high school, and I hadn't found alcohol yet. But at that point, like I said, I wanted to be popular. I had this growing need to just be wanted, you know. And the popular thing to do was I discovered alcohol. You know, that was the popular thing to do. So I did it. And when I found alcohol, it was my first spiritual awakening in my entire life. I mean, it really was. Since the first time I ever went to church on Sunday, I never had a spiritual awakening. Not once. But when I found alcohol, I mean, it was just so unbelievable. Because at that point, when I was like, I guess it was just 13, 14, people started to irritate me, and I started getting, you know, deep resentments against just people my age. You know, that if one girl didn't like me, the most attractive girl, and she didn't like me, then I developed resentment against her and just everybody. And when I found alcohol, it was just this. I just knew my life had changed. I knew when I found it that I'd been looking for something my entire life that I didn't know about. But when I found it, I knew. I finally found you. I didn't know I was even looking for this, but I found it. And my life, I just knew. I don't know if I can really describe it. I'm not that good with words, but I knew at that point that, man, this is. I just knew that's what I wanted to pursue for the rest of my life, was that feeling. Because when I, by the third or fourth beer, it was just complete jubilee, complete just amazement of just, my gosh, just a settling of my emotions that I'd never had since I was, you know, I don't know, six or seven. And it was just unbelievable. And by the fifth beer, I was already shotgunning beers. My fifth beer I've ever had, you know, I already shotgunned it because it was just, I already could not get it in enough. You know, I've heard people say, I started off a social drinker and then I had my second beer. You know, that was me, you know. I was, the second I discovered alcohol, I was to the races, man. And I remember when I woke up that morning, I just remember thinking, I'm going to pursue this and do this as every day. This is what I want. I just thought about it. From the second I found it, that's all I thought about. Freshman year of high school was when this happened. I was the president of my class. I was top honors. I was starting freshman on the soccer team. I was involved in forensics debate. I had to be the best at everything. After I discovered alcohol, and by the time I became a senior, I did not make the soccer team. I got kicked off the baseball team. Instead of being the president, also I was on the honor court as a freshman. I was like the first person ever to be nominated to be on this honor court because I went to a military high school and we had this honor system and of students that were on this honor court. Instead of being on the honor court senior year, I mean, every month they met, I was having to face the honor court. You know, I was like I was supposed to be on the honor court and on the other side at the same time. You know, it just didn't work. So by the time I was a senior, all that stuff was gone. The only team I was on was the drinking team, man. That's all I cared about was drinking. And I cannot believe how, when I look back, just how rapid I became so just drenched in needing alcohol. I never had the shakes or anything, but just mentally, it was just always on my mind, and everything was so difficult for me in high school. You know, like I said, and it wasn't. You know, I mean, you look at my life. People look at my life and say, "Man, you got it easy." And I did. I was spoiled. You know, but for me, it was just so difficult to get up and go to class. It was just. It took everything because I had no social capacity to meet with people while I was sober. Even at 16 years old, it just scared the crap out of me. I didn't know how to deal with it, and I started dealing with it by getting angry. You know, and just whenever anybody would say anything to me, I'd flip off. I'd just flip a lid. I just didn't know how to. If anybody ever said anything to me that was just a slight discomfort to me, it was just a matter of time before I'd just flip on you. You know, and no matter who you were. You know, you could be a parent, you could be an authority figure, you could be a female, male. It didn't matter. I just did not know how to deal with it. It was just like my drinking. By drinking, it got to the point 2 years in where I could not control how much I took. You know, when I took a drink, I was off to the races, you know. It didn't matter how. I mean, all bets were off. And even to the point where I couldn't look you in the eye and tell you I'm not going to drink tonight and hold my end up at the bargain, you know, at the deal. There were times where when I was 17 years old, my father, and this is when it started really getting bad. I mean, already 2.5 years in, everybody was telling me I was an alcoholic. At 17, people, my teachers, everybody was saying, "You have a drinking and drug problem." And my father, the only time I've ever seen him cry was my senior year, and it was really bad at this point. He came into the room, and my sister was having alcohol problems going in and out of halfway houses, and my father stopped me and said, "Todd, I'm having a mental breakdown. I can't take it." And he started crying. He's like, "Please, whatever you do, do not go out and drink tonight." And I looked him straight in the eye, and I said, "Dad, I will not drink tonight. I promise you, I will not drink tonight." You know, I mean, it was a very moving event for me to see my father cry for the first time in my entire life. And obviously he was hurting, but I can't tell you why. I showed up that night 3 a.m. drunk. You know, I mean, the most inopportune times, I still got drunk. I can't tell you, I made a conscious decision not to drink that night, and I still got drunk. You know, I was like, what is going on, man? You know? And, just life, I just could not deal with life. It was just so difficult for me. I don't know why, but, I just always thought about whenever I did do something that was good, it was basically to get my parents off my back, or I just did stuff in order to get to the alcohol. You know, that's the only time I get. That was my only motivation. Is I would do well in school in order to get my parents off my back. And I grew up in a very strict household as well. My parents did not allow alcohol in the house or anything. You know, and I was just getting into a whole lot of trouble with my parents and started developing deep, deep resentments against them because, I don't know, I just developed hatred against everybody, just irritated with people, man. I just did not want to be around people. If I could just, you know, back then if they had high school online, I could just do that. I could have aced everything. But when I had to deal with people, man, I just couldn't do it, you know. And I had my first girlfriend when I was a junior in high school, and this is what happened is, gosh, I need to get through my drinking here. Tell us one story and I'll speed it up. Just because this was a huge moving point in my life, in my drinking. Like I said, the love was in my family was not expressed verbally. You know, I felt my parents love me. But so I had my first girlfriend. About 6 months into this relationship of this girl, I told her, I love you. And when I said that, the first time I can ever remember telling anyone I love you, I mean, that was like, it was just unbelievable, that feeling when I said that to her. And she had no idea that meant there were many expectations now, you know? You know? But because I haven't trusted you with something I've never trusted anyone in my entire life with, and that's love, you know? And I had no idea what that meant. I thought I love you meant, I mean, you're going to love me, I'm going to get something in return, you know? I thought love meant, I'm going to get something, you know, and just some kind of affection or anything, you know, and that's not my definition of love today. I know love is unconditional. You know, I give it to someone without anything, expecting anything back, but I expected a whole lot back. And when that girl, when she got smart, obviously, and realized I was crazy and an alcoholic and not healthy, she dumped me. And I remember when she dumped me, I remember just, it was the most depressing event that I've had to go through, really, up to my life now, at this point. But I remember thinking, I will never, ever, ever, ever tell anyone ever that I love them ever again. I will never love anybody because I cannot take this feeling. And from that point on, I drank and I drugged. I mean, just obsessively all the time. I mean, my friends didn't think I could take it to another level, and I took it 3 times up to another level. It was just getting high before class. I mean, it was just awful, you know. And by senior year, I almost got kicked out 3 times in my high school, barely got out, and went into college, where I developed deep resentments against my parents. The last day I left for college, I didn't leave on good terms. I basically told my parents, I hate your guts, and when I fail in life, it's going to be your fault. That's what I left college for. Not this, you know, looking back today, when parents, you know, send their kids to college, it's usually kind of an emotional, happy time. Not mine. Mine was, filled with deep resentment, and I verbally abused my parents and physically abused my parents many times. And many times I didn't know about until after I got sober. So college was total, total just chaos. Only lasted a semester. Could not keep up with my drinking. The obsession to drink was on my mind 24/7. Had to join a fraternity just to keep up. They said, you know, this pledging thing, we're going to force you to drink Hot Mad Dog. That's supposed to be a penalty, you know, for pledging. I'm like, I want to pledge for, you know, all 4 years of college or however long it takes. I love this, you know. But I want to pledge more than one fraternity, you know. I moved into the fraternity house first semester of my freshman year. I moved in while I was pledging, you know. I mean, that's the stupidest idea that anyone had ever heard of, because that means, I mean, basically the, I mean, it's like setting myself up to get hazed all the time, but I didn't go to class. I did not go to class. The first week I went to class, I never went to class another day until I got sober. Never, ever showed up. Not one day did I ever show up to class. And when people ask me, how are you doing? I just, my head was so full of lies, I truly believed I was acing all my classes. I'm like, I'm doing awesome. You know? I truly thought, like, I'm doing great. You know? I was just such in a mental fog and just, and it got to the point where my fraternity, I got kicked out of the fraternity house for, I was just a total, total wreck. And, it was funny because I'd have to keep on meeting new people because the first night you drank with me, man, you thought I was just so much fun, man. I mean, you had a blast with me the first time you drank with me, you know? But then the second night you drank with me, I got a little annoying. By the third night, you hated me, you know? Because you realized, you know, it wasn't one of those guys that, man, Todd got really drunk last night. It wasn't just one of these one-offs, you know? The next night, daggone, Todd got really drunk again last night and made a fool of himself. And it was every single night. Somehow I ended up naked under a bush somewhere with a gorilla mask on, and there were pictures taken of me everywhere. And I mean, just all these stuff happening to me. I ended up in jail in a tutu. I mean, it was unreal what happened to me. Just blackouts, and it's funny now, but it was scary then because I went into blackouts and I'd wake up in places I had no idea where I was, you know, I wake up and not remember like an entire day and a half of my life. Like the last thing I remember when I wake up would be I wake up Wednesday morning, and the last thing I remember was Sunday night. And I was just like, "What in the world is going on?" Like I had no, I thought I was going, oh, I was crazy, but I seriously thought I was like going into a time warp. I didn't know what was going on, and got to the point where I started hanging out with people. You know, I could not keep up with my surroundings. And the fraternity members didn't like hanging out with me anymore. So I started having to hang out with people that weren't even at the college that didn't speak English. I hung out at the laundromat during the day. There's a ABC store right beside it that I could get, because I was only 17, but I got people to buy me beer. Because I had all the savings that my grandmother had left me, one of my grandmothers, and I had like $20,000 that I used up in 6 months on alcohol and drugs. And so I hung out at this laundromat with these people that didn't speak English, and I remember sitting there like on a Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock behind the laundromat with my brown paper bag, 17 years old, thinking, this is the life, man. Like, this is exactly where I want to be. No one is going to say anything about my drinking, because I got to the point where everybody was saying, man, you got a drinking problem. You know, even my drug dealer was telling me I got a problem, you know. And so the thing was is that I don't know if these people that I was hanging out with were telling me I had a problem or not. I couldn't understand what they were saying. So, I mean, it was awesome. It was perfect drinking, you know. I loved it, you know. But the thing that happened is I got into tons of trouble, and when I wasn't drinking, actually stopped, the alcohol stopped working. Because, like I said, I would drink one beer and go into a blackout, or I'd drink 20 beers, and I was dead sober, stone cold sober at 20 beers. You know, I'd start at 10 a.m., and at 9 at night, I'm still sober. I'm sitting there. And I started having suicidal thoughts, all this resentment, fear, all this stuff coming in. And I could not get rid of it. It was crazy. You know, I was delusional. I thought when I got this case of Natty Light that somebody had tricked, you know, me into thinking it was Natty Light and poured it all in water, took the alcohol out. Like I did not know what was going on. And that's when it really got bad because I didn't have my solution. Alcohol was my solution to my living problem. And also, I got a bunch of drunk in publics. I was so delusional, I just didn't show up. Because the first time I showed up, they told me I had to go to ASAP. And the first time I went to ASAP, I failed the breathalyzer. They told me I was going to have to take a breathalyzer. I told myself I couldn't drink that night. I got drunk, I don't know how, and I showed up drunk. And they gave me a breathalyzer and told me I was drunk. And I looked them in the face, I was like, I'm not drunk. I don't care what that thing says, I am not drunk. I have not been drinking. They're like, This says you're drunk. And you could have a video camera of me stealing something. I'd say that wasn't me. You know, I could not face that. So I just stopped showing up. I was supposed to go into an intensive outpatient program. I just didn't show up. I just said, I'll deal with it. You know, they understand I have good intentions, you know. And deep down, man, I knew something was wrong. And deep down, I knew I was a good person. But the actions weren't showing it. I could not figure out why. I wanted to do the right thing. I wake up every morning saying, I'm changing. I got to do something different. You know, I'm going to go to class. But then I'd realize I haven't been to class in 3 months. I don't even know where the class is. And just that thought was that's too much effort for me to figure out where my class is. You know, might as well get drunk. And so it got to the point where I was suicidal. I got back into the fraternity house. I had 2 warrants out for my arrest, and I had to start evading the police. And I just broke down one day went back to the fraternity house and said, I don't know what to do. I've been living on couches for a couple weeks, and they said, you need to call your parents. So I called my parents, and I told them I need help. I don't know what to do. And they said, we'll be right there. And they drove down that night, picked me up. I turned myself in, and the Harrisonburg County Police allowed me to drive directly to Richmond and go into a detox, and I didn't have to do jail time if I were to complete this treatment program. So, jail treatment, you know, I was like, oh, well, that's an easy decision. You know, even an alcoholic can make that decision. So, treatment. And at this point, I knew I was done with whatever was bothering me. I didn't know what it was, but, man, I was just sick, you know. It wasn't working. I was suicidal. And I just went in with an open mind. But at the same time, there were barriers for me to recover, and a lot. So I went into this detox. I detoxed. Went to this treatment facility. It was an intense outpatient program. Thank God my parents allowed me to come live with them during this time. I learned I was an alcoholic in there. That was what treatment gave me. It taught me that I was an alcoholic, or what alcoholism was. I wasn't sure if I was. I really didn't want to be, because the first thing I heard in treatment was that, well, first I was trying to play these games, try not to be alcoholic. I said, you know, denial is the first symptom. So when we run around the room, I'd say, my name is Todd, and I think I might have been an alcoholic. I thought that I might have covered everything, so that maybe I'm not an alcoholic, but I was, and now I can drink. I control my drinking somehow when I get out of here, you know. But I suffered from just awful depression, and I told the doctor that I met with that when I came out of detox, that, what's your problem? I said, severe depression, and that's leading me to drink. And what I learned was alcoholism is the foundation disease, you know. Like, if I don't deal with my alcoholism, people might have other sicknesses and illnesses, but if I don't deal with the alcoholism, nothing else is going to get fixed, you know. I mean, there's no way anything can get fixed. If I have depression, I can't just deal with depression if I also have alcoholism, you know. I mean, I know a guy I'm friends with has, I mean, he's got multiple personality disorder, and he's an alcoholic. If he doesn't deal with his alcoholism, there's no way he can deal with his multiple personality disorder, you know. I mean, it's just, there's no way, because alcoholism is a foundation disease, a primary disease. And that's what this doctor kind of, I mean, and he said it a lot in better terms than I could, but he made me realize that, oh, maybe I'm depressed because I drink, you know. I thought it was, I drink because I'm depressed. And maybe I'm depressed because it's part of my alcoholism. And so he said, maybe you have alcoholism. And the treatment center I went to, the intensive outpatient, they made me go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's kind of mandatory to go to 2 meetings a week or something. So I went into AA, not happy to be going into an AA meeting at 18 years of age. I thought, there's no way. They're probably going to kick me out. I'm too young. That's what I thought. Going in, I thought, they're probably going to look at me and say, you're not allowed in here. You know, I really thought that there's no way I have alcoholism at 18 years of age, you know. And I came in, and, you know, the treatment center said, see if you relate, see if you can relate. So it was a speaker meeting, and there was a woman. I'm like, okay, I'm a man, I can't relate. So, you know, I was just already trying to figure out stuff that, how can I not be an alcoholic? But when the woman started telling her story, and not really how she drank, but the feelings and emotions and stuff she went through, and the character defects that came out of it, I was spot on, man. I was like, that is me, you know? I had never heard anyone describe me better than this woman who was 45 years old, and I was 18 years old. And it's the first time in my life I ever related to someone like that. And it was just unreal. I couldn't help but say, oh my gosh. Like, I think I'm one of them, you know? And they were so happy when I went in there. I was nervous as all get out, but this guy came up to me and shook my hand. And this is the first time I'd heard this in a long time, but he told me, come back. You know, well, I didn't hear that when where I went. You know, I heard get out and with a few choice words in between, you know. I never heard come back, you know. So that right there filled kind of that need for me to want have attention and feel wanted. You know, that's what I always searched for. And this and the first meeting I ever went to, thank gosh, it was a meeting where they practiced the primary purpose of helping newcomers and carrying the message. Because right when I when I went in there, man, they were just greeting me. I thought I was the most important person in the room, and it, I mean that was enough to get me to come back, you know. And really, I was, you know. But I didn't know it was because I was the sickest person in the room too, probably. You know, I thought it was because I was just this new phenom, you know, that came into the rooms. So I really stayed sober for about 30 days, just off the energy of keep coming back. I mean, seriously, that term kept me sober for 30 days. Well, I don't think that is. I think now that I look back, I don't know what happened. I had a moment of clarity when I left the scene I was at. Knew I had a problem. And somehow the stars aligned. Something else was involved that aligned the stars for the phenomenon of craving that I had to leave me for enough time to get into Alcoholics Anonymous and start working this thing a little bit for me to start recovering. I look back and I think it's just, there's no way that I did that. I had any part in that. It was just, the stars were aligned perfectly for that craving to be removed for just enough time for me to get some kind of clarity and clearance in my life to see the truth for the first time in my life when I went to these meetings and see who I was to think, all right, yeah, I relate to those people. They look really happy. I've never laughed like that in my entire life unless I was, you know, 24 beers in. I want to do that, man, you know? And they said, this is how we did it. This is how we got there. And so I was willing to do it. Just because, well, I was willing to at least try, you know, at the beginning. And that I guess that took about 3 or 4 months for me to get there. And for those 3 or 4 months, God just did for me what I could not do for myself. You know, it's just, there's just no other explanation. And the reason I have to make that point is because I fought the spirituality of this program for about a year once I got into it, you know, because I just, I found out I was an agnostic. So they told me you got to get a sponsor, and you have to, this one guy told me I had to go to as many meetings as nights I drank. I'm like, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me, man. Like, and so I had barriers when I came in. I was young, and I thought my life was over. I really did. I thought, I mean, I knew that if I drank, I truly believed, I kind of had gotten involved in coming to understand the first step without having a sponsor, that if I drank, that bad things were going to happen. And then eventually I was either going to die or end up in jail. I mean, I could not deny that. But the alternative that I saw was people were happy, but we were going to a meeting every night and then going to Shoney's every other night afterwards. And I was hanging out with people twice my age. There wasn't anybody my age. And we were all smoking and just sitting around. And at first I loved it, but then I'm thinking, I needed more fireworks or pizzazz for me to be attracted to it. You know, I was like, my life is over, man. You know, I'm hanging out with these people. I have to do this for the rest of my life. You got to be kidding me. I was thinking I'd rather drink myself to death, you know, and enjoy the ride, you know. I mean, but thank gosh, I found a guy that, he had two sleeves of tattoos, you know, and he just looked like this cool dude. And I thought, you know, I mean, he's going to kind of let me slide a little bit in this program, you know, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And God was looking out again because he was cool and not how I thought he was. I mean, he was spiritually on point, man, you know, and he was doing this thing. You know, I thought he was kind of just a guy hanging around the back that I could just kind of chill with and make fun of everybody. This guy put me to work, man, you know. But I liked him, man. He had something I wanted, you know. I mean, I like this guy. He became my higher power. I mean, right from the get-go, he was my first higher power. So much. I mean, I was obsessed with this guy because he just seemed so comfortable in his skin. I'd never seen someone. He was like 30. So that was the youngest person I could find when I got sober, and he just seemed so comfortable in his skin. for being that young at the time, that I was like, man, I want to get there. I want to be like him. Just be so comfortable. When we were around other people our age, you just didn't care what other people thought. I'm just standing, and when we were around people, other young people or anybody, I'm just like freaking out, you know? And I just wanted what he had, you know? I mean, to the point where 3 months in, I got a tattoo, my first tattoo, because, you know, I thought it would please this guy, you know? I mean, I really, like, look, dude, I got a tattoo, you know? And he didn't react like I thought he would, but he wasn't like sweet, you know. But anyways, the most important thing this guy did was take me through the steps in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, from the first time, I think the night I asked him to be my sponsor, I joined that home group, his home group, and we met that night and started going through the Big Book that night. You know, I mean, he didn't mess around. You know, I mean, we went through it, and I just didn't have anything else to do, better to do, you know, and I wanted what this dude had. You know, I had no idea what it was. I didn't know it was some kind of spiritual connection that he was going to guide me to get to. And I think God put this person in my life because that was the only person that I trusted. That I don't know how I was able to trust. Well, this guy had one rule, and he told me that. You need to be completely honest with me. He said, that's my one rule. I don't care what you do. I don't care if you go out and get drunk. You need to be 100% completely honest with me, no matter what you're thinking or doing. And that was very difficult, but I trusted this guy, and I said yes, and I told this guy, I mean, before I even got to the fourth and fifth, I was telling this guy just crazy thoughts I was having, you know, and I just totally trusted this guy. And this guy, he never looked at me like, whoa, you know, he always looked at me like, been there, you know, or he always, like, he just seemed to just be so cool with it, you know. I was like, man, it's so awesome, you know, I finally have opened up to this person that understood, you know. And so we went through through the steps, and this is, I don't know how this worked, but this is the only guy who got me to really be willing to believe that something greater in my life was working, and that was the solution, is that when I worked through this thing, that I was going to have a spiritual awakening. And I thought, I think I'm just going to learn how to control my life, you know. And I thought, I don't think all these steps apply to me when I went through it. And the only reason I told him that. I was so comfortable with him that I would think that with other people. You know, they say, you need to do this, do you do this? Oh, yeah, I know, we're going to do this. I don't need to do that crap. You know, but with this guy, I could not lie to him. And when we got to a step, I'd say, I don't think I need to do this. You know? And he'd tell me why I needed to and what was going to happen if I didn't. And I believed him, you know? And I had amazing experiences happen to me. And I had a spiritual awakening as a result. When I got to the ninth step, I was scared to death. But he told me that this is really where people either kind of try to coast and end up jumping off. You know, he said he liked to say that if you're on a bicycle, the only time you can coast is if you're going downhill. You know, and I like that because it means you always got to be pedaling. You know, if you want to grow, you got to pedal. And that was he was about, you know, pedaling. And so he told me, he was the one who told me which one I should do first. And this is about, you know, like I took my time with it, even though he wanted me to jump right into it. This is about a year sober. I had left, got my own apartment with another guy in AA, and started making a financial amends to my parents. And it was time for the big sit down. To start my amends to my parents, to be to be a better son, and I didn't have a great relationship with my parents at the time, but I knew I needed to do it. So we went through the routine with my sponsor, what I was going to say, and so I sat my parents down and told them in a general way. You know, I didn't get into all the specifics. I didn't want to hurt them, you know, more than I already had. And I told them I was a bad son, and that there were a lot of things that I did wrong. Then I hurt you a lot. I know that. I was wrong for everything I did. You know, I was wrong for being a bad son. I want to do whatever it takes to make it up. And I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make this right, you know. And the reactions I got were just unbelievable. My dad actually asked me, which was very difficult. He asked me, I was in a blackout one time. Apparently, I found out. He asked me if I was truly going to basically try to kill him. because apparently one time when I was in a blackout, I threatened to hit him over the head with a baseball bat if he didn't get out of my way to get out of the house and get alcohol. And it was very difficult because I guess he didn't know I was in a blackout. So when I heard him say that, when he said, "Were you really going to hit me over the head with a baseball bat?" I had no clue what he was saying. And when I realized, my God, I was in a blackout and I did this, I said, "Dad, I can't tell you I wouldn't have, but I can tell you this: I'm going to do everything in my power to be the best son I can from now on." You know, and that was the first time I'd hugged my father since I ever remembered. My mother, this goes to show just how much she didn't trust me. She had an English paper I wrote in junior year that journal paper it was. About some kind of personal experience that I had, and she kept it, and she never believed that I had truly written that paper. She always thought I had plagiarized it. Always. And she asked me every 3 months after I'd written that paper, since up to this point, "Did you really write this paper?" You know, or she never pulled it out, but she was like, "Did you really write that paper junior year that you got an A on?" It's like, yes, I did. And I really did write it, you know. But my mom still had that paper. And she went and got it, and she asked me, she said, "I have one question. Did you really write this paper?" You know? it's very trivial now. It's funny. And I told her, "Yes, I really did write that paper." And she said, "That's the first time I've ever believed you when I've asked that question." And it was just unbelievable that my mom really didn't even believe that I was just putting words on a paper. She could not believe anything I wrote, said, or anything. You know, she just, it was all lies. And I told my mom, "I love you." And that was the first time I've ever told my mom, "I love you." And it was okay to say that, you know. And it wasn't easy, but it was okay to say that to them, you know. My mom said, "I love you too." And I gave her a hug. And it was just unbelievable that I just was able to say those words when I was so scared of saying that for some reason. Because I thought that meant... I put stuff with love, like I said, I put expectations with love that I was never going to let anybody have again. And now I was like, "I just love you, you know, it's okay, you know." And that, it's just an unbelievable experience. And from that point on, my relationship with my parents has just developed. Now, I went into a little bit of a slide in Alcoholics Anonymous after that, I did well for 2 years. And 3 years in, it just got a little redundant, the same meetings. I wasn't involved in service work yet. I mean, not real service work, but I was making coffee and stuff, but I wasn't carrying the message. You know, I was sponsoring people, but I just wasn't fully involved in service work. I had plateaued, and not because I was supposed to, it's because I made the decision to plateau. You know, and the thing I found is that it's unbelievable that it's not a bad thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, but Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, I know from my experience, if you really work it, it turns your life around so much. Like, so many great things happen that AA doesn't become important. That's what I've seen with people, is that most people that I've seen that go back out when they get some time, it's not because things are going bad. It's because things get great, man, you know? And it's like alcoholics forget, why did it get great, you know? Because I put recovery first, that's why. They go back out and drink, you know, and think, "I'm where I need to be." And I got to that point. I said, "Man, I'm where I need to be." And my sponsor relapsed. He went back out. And so that kind of cut off all ties with that, of me having some kind of... I developed a higher power at this point. I had a spiritual awakening, but not as strong as it needed to be. What happened is I stopped going to a lot of meetings. I didn't have a home group. I was kind of a gypsy in AA. I just kind of bounced around whenever I wanted to. I didn't go to a meeting to, help people. I went just to get a quick fix, kind of puke, spill my guts in a meeting real quick, or just tell someone what to do and then leave and feel, "Oh, man, I feel good," you know. And then the next day I felt like crap. And it drove me to, my life was just going so good, I needed to focus on other things, you know. I needed to start dating. You know, finally at 3 years, I'm like, man, to tell you to wait a year, I had to wait 3 years, you know, because I was so sick, you know, I could not be healthy, let alone in just a regular relationship that's non-sexual with someone. I mean, it took me 2 years just to figure that out, that in order to get over the fear of meeting people, or I'd walk into a place, and in order to get over that fear, what I need to do is come up to them and say hi. Like, that's how I get over it. I walk through it. You know, I thought somehow one day I was going to come into a a room, and I was going to give her that fear because every single person in there was going to come up to me and say hi. You know, why don't you call me? You know, that's why I don't have friends, because no one calls me. You don't have friends because you don't call anybody. You know, you don't introduce yourself to anybody. That's how you walk through it. And when I started doing that, people were like, man, you're so social. And I wasn't social. You know, it was just like, no, I'm not. I'm antisocial, but I got to do this to get over it. You know, that's the only reason I'm doing it. So it's weird how I learned Alcoholics Anonymous just has taught me all this stuff, how to just be okay with people and just be comfortable in my own skin. But I went through a very difficult period when I let go of Alcoholics Anonymous and my higher power. And I was in a relationship for like a week and a half, went on one date, that didn't go well. So, you know, I mean, one date in, I'm already like, will you marry me? You know, I mean, I'm just like, oh my gosh, this girl is just great, you know. That didn't work out, you know, so I'm freaking out over that. I don't have a sponsor. I moved in with a guy that I used to go to high school with that drank. I'm around it all the time. I'm living vicariously through him. We go out to a bar to meet some girls. I'm going out to a bar, you know, in AA. I mean, not in AA, but that's what I did instead of go to a meeting, was go to a bar. I didn't have any intentions of drinking. When I got to that bar, I saw the girl that I went on a date with, and I just sat there and I was like, screw it. I'm getting drunk. I can't take this. And for some reason, I had like 7 beers on the table that I was at. And for some reason, my hand would not pick up that drink. I cannot tell you why. I have no idea why. But it would, I just, for some reason, something greater in my life said, no. No, too many people need you, you know. Too many people. And you've already made your amends, and you need to live those out. You know, you need to put yourself back. I didn't hear this voice, but this is what I think now, is that God had better plans for me. And somehow he intervened again. And I went to a meeting the next night. Found the sponsor, and I've never looked back. And that was at, you know, 4 or 5 years of sobriety, and I've never looked back. I have gone full force into this thing. And the longer I stay in, the deeper I get, man. And it's been unbelievable what has happened in my life since then. Just a couple things real quick. Since then, I graduated from college, went back to college. I got married to an alcoholic who's a doctor. I don't know how that happened, but just a wonderful girl, you know. I've gotten involved in a home group that does service work. I'm thoroughly involved in carrying the message now. I am into action. You know, I don't just sit around and do a 10-step every night and think that's all I need to do. You know, I need to take my own inventory, but I also need to carry the message. And that's the most important thing for me. It's really 3 aspects of the program: recovery, the 12 steps, unity, being a home group, and service. Carry the message out. So I'm a treatment committee chairperson. I go into treatment centers at least twice a week, going in there and carrying the message. It's just, I found that new fire. Instead of just going to the same old meeting, sitting in there, getting redundant, I go in and I search out alcoholics, man. And their newcomers and detox units are fun, man. I mean, you'll see some crazy things in there, you know. I mean, I love it. But I also love leaving, you know. I'm like, man, I'm glad I'm leaving, you know. This is not my home group, you know. Not a good thing. So I do that type of work. I go into jails. I go into prisons. Whenever I'm asked something, I do it. I'm the Richmond Intergroup Treasurer. Not my favorite type of service work. Sometimes it's difficult for me to see how I'm helping the alcoholic, but my sponsor tells me I am, you know. He's like, if you really look at, I like the type of work that's, you know, one-on-one with a newcomer, you know. I don't like behind-the-scenes, you know, unsung jobs, you know. Maybe that's what I need, you know. I need to humble myself and say, because no one, you know, it's not like every week someone comes up to me and says, thank you so much for balancing the books, you know. I mean, you're just helping so many alcoholics, you know. That's what my mind thinks is, well, God, I don't want that stuff, but it does help me. It humbles myself that Alcoholics Anonymous needs that stuff, needs those unsung heroes to do that stuff in the background. And man, I'm just, my life is unbelievable. I love you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and the only reason I can think that everything that's happened so well in my life is not because I deserve it. I do not deserve this. It's just because, I guess, my higher power wants me to be an example for people that this thing can work. Because, I mean, and really, I mean, sometimes I think, like, God's, you know, like, there's something, you know, it's not going to go this well all the time, but sometimes it's gone bad. And I it's like, you know, recently here, just the state of everything, I'm just, and everybody's kind of full of fear. Am I working everywhere? And I'm just kind of like, should I be in fear? You know? And I talked to my sponsor about it. It's like, no. You know, you don't need to be in fear about anything. Like, did you lose your job today? No, not today. But I might, you know, 2 weeks. I might 3. Like, not today. Nothing changed today. You know? Like, It's just like, okay, it's okay for me not to be in fear, you know, and to just walk and just to be here today and to be in this moment and to be comfortable with myself is just so far from what I was. And the greatest compliment I've gotten today is when someone walks up to me that, you know, like doesn't know I'm an alcoholic and they're friends with me or something. And they say, let's go out and drink. And I tell them I don't drink. And they say, why? Sometimes, you know, if I think it's going to help or if I'm good friends, I'm like, no, I'm an alcoholic. And then they're like, I would never have guessed. I cannot believe you were an alcoholic. That is the greatest compliment I've ever had. Because if that means I've changed a lot. You know, if you really can't see where I'm an alcoholic, man, you need to look a little deeper. You know, because believe me, man. And it's funny, the other thing I hear is people who want to go out and drink with me. Because, you know, I mean, I like to have fun. And I'm, you know, kind of, I'm loose, you know. And I'll go out dancing or whatever. And they'll say, man, let's go out drinking. I tell them I don't drink. And I'm like, man, I cannot believe you don't drink. Like, we could have so much fun together. You know, I mean, you'd be so much fun to go out and drink. It's like, I think that they think, like, since I'm comfortable in my own skin when I'm sober, and I guess they're not, that for in order for them to get comfortable, they need to be drinking. And if I'm this comfortable sober, I'm going to be 10 times more comfortable drinking. I'm like, man, I wouldn't be, you know. We would not have fun if I went out drinking with you. It's not like I would be like this, you know. I would be, you know, waiting for you to turn around so I could steal your drugs or something, you know. I mean, with that, thank you so much for having me come speak tonight, and thanks a lot.